Voices from Africa. African Christmas, it's called. We also heard from Taylor Sorensen, Alethea, Love Came Just in Time. And it's 11 minutes after the hour. It is a Wednesday morning, and so we're treated to a visit from Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director out there in Columbia, Maryland, the base of operations for Preserving Bible Times. And so close to Washington, Doug is just he's at the hub of things there. Information floating around. I don't know how you concentrate on anything near Washington there. The vibes must be very disconcerting, chaotic even. But what is
it? Well, it's an intense low pressure area, so you know, you just have to deal with that.
An intense low pressure area?
This is all that thinking sinks to the low level.
Yeah.
Sometimes low pressure becomes a vacuum.
Kind of slithers along your ground.
Well, listen. By the way, thanks for making me feel very welcome this Wednesday morning. I've been listening for the last hour or so, and there's old Perry Como on Route
60. Yeah, he played.
I wondered if you were listening. Yeah,
wow. Yeah. Immediately followed by Bert Kempfert, who is one of my favorites. I love the syncopation in his
arrangements. Nice arrangements. Yeah, very
and
characteristic.
And then even had a Bayou Gumbo song. You know, I was down in Louisiana just not too long ago, and made me feel very at home this morning.
We didn't get a chance to talk to you about Louisiana. I know you visited. You taught there for a weekend at church. Did that go well? Did you have a good time?
I really did. Nicely received. It was in a United Methodist church there in Metairie. Metairie is the closest in suburb to New Orleans. So, you know, we were 10 minutes from Canal Avenue and probably 20 minutes from the Garden District and going out St. Charles Avenue to Tulane, which is just gorgeous housing. I mean, it's the finest collection of antebellum / Victorian neighborhoods I think I've ever seen anywhere. It was just fascinating.
Did you get to take in some Louisiana cuisine down there?
Absolutely. You know, Nancy and I honeymooned there 47 years ago.
I didn't know that. Okay.
I took her to the Court of the Two Sisters 47 years ago, and I took her back to the Court of Two Sisters on Royale Street.
I've got to tell you something. Let me slip this in. That's where we went on our honeymoon.
Did you really?
Yeah, we were at Court of Two Sisters. That was, of course, that marriage didn't work out. No portent there, Doug. No, nothing like that. It's just that.
You don't strike me as a bigamist.
No, I'm not.
Sorry, I was in the liquor store yesterday over the weekend, and I talked to the manager, and he starts telling me about
Baptist audience. By the way,
what's that?
There goes your Baptist audience.
Yeah, there goes the
clicking
Baptist,
off one by one.
But I was just in to get limes. But anyway, was talking to the manager. And he starts telling me about this new girl that he's dating, a woman he's going out with. And I said, "Don't you think your wife will mind? Particularly because you're talking about her." And he says, no, I've been divorced for 4 years. But now that I think about it, whenever you're in here, we always talk about you. And I said, you know, I'm getting tired of talking about me. Can you talk about me for a while?
Louisiana was a bright spot in your month then, huh?
Well, it was, and we actually took a couple days on either side of the speaking event, and we went upriver towards Baton Rouge and dropped in on 4 antebellum plantation homes that I had photographed 50 years ago.
Wow.
And it's sort of like before and after. Those 4 plantation homes have been completely refurbished. It's almost a campus. It's a destination. It's spas. It's restaurants. It's rooms. It's event venues. It was unbelievable, the before and after. But we had a good time because we knew the places before, and we could still enjoy them in the after.
I'm glad it was a good trip for you. And not only did you do some good from the front of that church, but you enjoyed yourself too, relaxed a little bit. That's good. Because
and they invited us back to in March.
All right.
Bring the last 40 days of Jesus. So, we're looking forward to returning in the spring. The azaleas should be out. The Garden District in New Orleans should just be gorgeous.
Of course, you'll be in our neck of the woods in March too. So,
actually, it's the week before that.
You'll get to see two extremes then, south and then north, all in the same week.
I know. We'll go from sunscreen to snowscreen.
I think so.
That'll be fun.
Hey, are you interested in current events?
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
is there any oil business down in New Orleans?
Things are booming. Actually, this might surprise you. New Orleans is the fastest growing city in the country right now. It's real estate prices are going through the roof. If a home is on the market for 2 days, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Most houses sell with 4 and 5 offers within 24 hours. Everybody wants in on New Orleans right now.
I didn't know that. I guess that's healthy.
And it's all because of the oil business?
Well, no, Katrina.
Oh. Oh, really?
All the rebuilding, the new, it's all...
The rebuilding, yeah, but so many people went down to Louisiana and New Orleans to help rebuild, you know, and disaster relief and all that sort of thing.
Our church sent many teams.
And they fell in love with the place.
Oh. Ah. Okay.
People now, that's the destination city. You graduate, you want to get a job in New Orleans, not New York or Washington or San Francisco.
That's an interesting turn of events. I hadn't heard
that. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, oil's important to them. It's important to Texas and Oklahoma. It's important to North Dakota, Canada. Now it's important to Russia. Big news in Russia these days. What's going on over there?
Oh, yeah. Well, since I know David loves conspiracy theories here, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, whenever supply and demand gets mismatched in the worldwide oil marketplace, OPEC makes an adjustment to sort of keep things in balance and to sort of stabilize prices. Absolutely fascinating that they haven't done that this time around.
Mm-hmm.
So why would that be? Well, Russia is a strong supporter of Syria. Syria, some would argue, is a proxy state of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Saudis and the Iranians are, you know, the Shiite Sunni kind of thing. They can't stand each other. So I'm wondering if the Saudis have said, we're going to let this oil drop, given this particular mismatch in supply and demand, not going to intervene. We're going to drive Russia to its knees. It won't be able to support Syria anymore, and maybe we can put this thing back in balance.
Interesting thought. Now,
That's a nice theory. I like that.
Dave and I have talked about the Saudi reaction being more directed at the shale oil producers in Canada and North Dakota, trying to price them out of the market. It could be a combination of all those things. I mean, it was an opportunity too good to pass up.
Well, I tell you, you heard it first on Broken Road Radio, probably the Drudge Report is going to cite you guys.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
As the source of the next conspiracy theory.
Yeah, or Vladimir will send a couple of agents to the studio, and then that could happen too, I suppose.
Well, he'd never find East Dakota, though.
That's true. We're well hidden here, surrounded by uncharted territory. Doug Greenwald is the senior teaching fellow, as I mentioned. We normally talk about the historic and cultural context of Scripture in Israel. Now, in recent months, we've gone to the historic and cultural context of the Roman Empire, and how that affected what Paul did, how he nurtured his churches in that area. But now it's the Advent series and our season, and one of the things that we delight in here is kind of revealing some of the romanticized and sterilized and simplistic traditionalized notions of what Advent means. How, and I say Advent itself, the word comes from the church, probably 3rd-4th century. And it's kind of a penitential period. It's a dark period. They dwell on the time before the birth of Christ at this point. But things weren't necessarily like that. They were anticipating him back in Israel in the first century, weren't they?
They were anticipating Messiah to literally appear 12 years from this moment in time. It's all part of the 70-year cycle. That's part of rabbinic thinking. The start date for this particular 70-year cycle would be when Pompey and the Roman Legion invaded the land in 63 BC. It cycles back to the exile in 586 and the rededication of the temple in 516. That's a 70-year differential. And, of course, Rome is another invader. Restart the 70-year clock for when we're going to be delivered. And ironically enough, the 70th year in this 70-year cycle way of thinking is when Jesus is 12 years old in the temple in Luke 2, holding his own with the best rabbinic minds of his day.
It really, really shines a spotlight on that particular event. So what we're saying then is this 70-year notion did not apply to Old Testament times before the exile then, but it's really happened since the Babylonian exile that 70-year cycle came into their consciousness.
Right, and the other part of that 70-year bookend is in 516 when the temple was rededicated in Jerusalem, built, mm-hmm. you know, from the return of the three waves of exiles from Babylon with Ezra and Nehemiah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's just part of the irony. You know, we got to think, why in the world is Luke giving us this 12-year story, you know, when Jesus is 12 years old and gets left behind in Jerusalem? I think the answer is because of the 70-year cycle. Messiah really did come to the temple on the 70th year. They just missed him.
You know, that's interesting to look at and ask why Luke put that in his book. We usually read scripture and we say, okay, that's there. All right. But we hardly ever analyze the whys and wherefores of the author. We may analyze the whys and wherefores of the characters and the events we see internally, but seldom do we step back and say, well, why did he say that? Why did he include that?
If you go to John, particularly at the end of John, he said, if everything that Jesus did and said were written down, there wouldn't be a library big enough to hold all this stuff. Well, mm-hmm. that tells us they're picking and choosing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first question you have to ask, or not the first, but you know, one of the first, why did the gospel author pick this particular incident to highlight, you know? And the answer usually is because he's building a flow of events that create some themes at 5,000 feet that he wants to develop. And when you start to think that way, you start to see and discover the themes at 5,000 feet that we never even think about when we do the ground level analyses of these passages.
You know, my tendency is always to read scripture like I'm reading a journalistic historic time sequence here, which really robs you of a lot of the basic understanding. If you understand that each author wrote at a particular time in a particular way for a particular reason, a whole bunch of things come to light.
Well, yeah, and three of the four gospel writers are Jewish, and Luke's the only Gentile. Luke is more into chronology, but a Jewish writer isn't necessarily into chronology. It's not a big deal to him. He's taking these events, and if he needs to move them around a little bit, because he's building a theme. And so he picks the incidents that build his theme. And if you understand approaching scripture that way, it sort of mitigates the need to try to understand this eternal argument that seemed to have gone on, is were there two cleansings of the temple or one? Because John puts it very early on in the life of Jesus, and the other gospel writers have it at the end during Passion Week. And if you understand that the gospel writers, if they're Jewish, might move things around to develop a theme, that whole textual criticism thing sort of evaporates.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was the census. There was the response on the part of Joseph, a trip to Bethlehem. We kind of talked about that last week. Where do we go next? We talked about why they were in Nazareth to begin with, which was interesting.
Let's talk about the trip. I think I said this last week. When Rome does the census, it allows at least a 12-month window of time for you to do your bit in the census. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't think like election day where everyone shows up and votes at one time. Understanding it that way sort of takes away the argument that Bethlehem was super crowded and therefore there was no room in the inn. You know, that whole traditional
way. It's an interesting aspect because this was a very complex undertaking in a society. And this was empire-wide, by the way. It was not just in Israel.
Absolutely.
But as for Israel, everybody walked. Everybody had scores of miles to go before they could get, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but there was a lot of crisscrossing, people on the roads going back to their clan hometowns. And we kind of lose that concept here. We don't have such things, do we, hometowns?
Well, really. The other thing is, and very few people lived away from their clan. I think mm-hmm. we lose this notion. The vast majority of people who were born in a village died in that village, and except for going to temple, probably never traveled more than a mile away from home
mm-hmm.
their whole lifetime.
Hmm.
So with that backdrop, I think Luke would expect us to raise the question, if most of the clans are living around their city, and there's even some contemporary examples of that. I remember Jim Martin, who helped found Preserving Bible Times with me 15 or so years ago, told me about a time in the summer when he had to lay over in Jerusalem, and he got invited to a wedding in the north. And he went, and it was a small town of 3,200 people, and 2,600 of the people had the same last name.
26, that's, yeah.
So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that would be very common in the first century. So Luke would expect us to be stunned by the fact that the paterfamilias, the head of the clan of David, is headquartered in Bethlehem. And here's a Davidic clan member living 90 miles away. Hmm. How do you explain this?
Well, and we talked about that. There were a number. There's nothing in Scripture to tell us that, but there are hints at it. We know that you talked about that wave of immigration that came from Babylon back in the Hasmonean times. Once Jews were in charge of Israel again, it invited another wave to come back, and they came back with specific objectives, specific expectations, and many of them settled in the northern part of Israel, in the Galilee region, and that's kind of where Nazareth is.
Yeah, and there's another school of thought that says Joseph is a tradesman. He's not particularly a carpenter. You couldn't make a living just as a carpenter in that culture. So, but Herod the Great is doing all these massive building projects, often conscripting tradesmen to force them to build his projects. It could be that Joseph's father said, I'm out of here, out of Bethlehem. I am not going to be conscripted by Herod to build his projects. I'm going to go in the north where Herod can't reach me. I mean, it's another argument. We don't know the precise answer. There are a number of ways to look at it, but we have to stop and pause and say, why are these Davidic clan members living up in the north? Now, there's another issue. In Luke 2:4,
before you get too much further, you said there is a number of Davidic members, Davidic clan members living far away in the north. Do you have a feeling for how many there were, or was so Joseph was not a lone wolf? He was a part of a larger group.
Well, we suspect somewhere between 200 and maybe 1,000 people were living in Nazareth at the time, since they are all pretty much part of the clan of Natsur from the Mishnah. Probably many of them, if not most of them, are Davidic clan members.
Okay.
And speaking of the north, one of the things that's just starting to dawn on my consciousness here, I just automatically used to think that the Jews were the primary people who populated the north, and there were these pockets of Gentile cities. I'm coming to the reverse conclusion. The north was primarily filled with Gentiles with pockets of Jewishness. So it's just another perspective. Most of the Gentile cities were substantial. Gadara, Gergesa, Sepphoris are all cities of 10, 15, 17,000 people. And we got Capernaum at 7,000 max. We've got Chorazin at 4,000 people. Bethsaida, maybe 3,000 people. It really is almost the reverse. The Jews at the time of Jesus seem to be in the vast minority in the north, mostly surrounded by very substantial Gentile establishments and cities.
And that may argue in support of the notion that they were there for the revolution. They were there for the Messiah, and it might explain some of their extremism, their zealousness for getting rid of the Romans and getting rid of the Gentiles, in fact, subjugating the Gentiles, because they felt like the underdog at the time, and that's not what prophecy had led them to believe would happen.
I know, and it almost puts them into a settlement mentality in the same way that the settlements are taking place in the West Bank today with Jewish people.
Enclaves, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we got this issue now. So we know Joseph's up in the north, and we know Mary is his betrothed wife. And in Luke 2:4, Luke tells us that Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which was called Bethlehem. How did he get from Nazareth to Bethlehem? Mechanically, how did he get there?
Well, I figure he's got to walk.
Okay, so let's have him walking, and how's Mary going to get there?
Well, she's pregnant now.
Right?
She's walking, too.
Well, maybe. Those were tough women back then, you know.
Well, and there's Joe Boxer commercial on, you know, with five pregnant women dancing in pajamas. So, yeah, you know, I guess the notion that pregnant women are necessarily, you know, dainty and
fragile
are not fragile and not able to you know, go out and do, because I see images of pregnant women working in fields, you know, throughout history. Yeah, we've got this modern notion that a woman, because she's pregnant, 2 months later has to become bedridden. I don't know.
That might be an old-fashioned notion even here in our culture, though. Yeah, I'm not sure that we still believe that. That's like a 1950s thing. But Mary and Joseph, well, there would have been beasts of burden. Conceivable, she could have ridden a donkey. And I see Christmas cards that way, and I go, ew, I don't think so.
Well, I don't think so. That must be the answer if it's on darts.
Well, if that's evidence, then. There must be. Okay, Hallmark has got it.
Hallmark can't lie, no.
Well, you know, so did Joseph's family wealthy enough to have a donkey? How did he get permission to use it if they did? Hey, Dad, I got this.
Can I have the donkey for the weekend, Dad?
I'd like to borrow the donkey over the weekend.
Because I got a pregnant woman who I haven't married yet. You know, I don't know how that all works. But if they did walk, they're walking about 16 to 18 miles a day for 5 days. All right. This is a frame of reference here. Now, let me ask you another question. All the Christmas cards I've seen have Joseph holding a little cord, pulling the donkey with Mary sitting on it behind him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I've seen that. Yep.
Literally impossible.
Not only have I seen it that way, but it was nighttime and there was a single star in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, that's even
mixing
more
metaphors. Yeah.
First off, this is observant Judaism. And the rabbis have said that men and women cannot commingle.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So if you travel, you travel in caravans. And there's a male caravan, and the women's caravan must be at least an hour behind it. Okay?
An hour separation. That's for the sake of proper decorum, or is that a security thing?
No, that's a purity issue.
Oh, okay. Okay? Wow.
Can't commingle men and women. Now, the other reason you travel in a caravan is because it's dangerous to travel alone. Mm-hmm. So the whole notion that Mary and Joseph are first together and traveling alone, I mean, just couldn't even possibly be.
Well, we talked about gangs of young ruffians. They're thieves, and they were also just politically minded people. Kind of like, you kind of think of some of the extreme Islamic groups. They were there to destroy the Romans, to destroy anything that wasn't strictly traditionally Jewish, weren't they? Including Gentiles, yeah.
The Zealots, most of the Zealots were probably headquartered in the north. That's where it was most intense. Mm-hmm. But we're beginning to open up some unknowns.
Might there have been a Roman guard? Wouldn't the Romans have had a vested interest in preserving security of trade and people moving along the roads? Would they have provided some security, maybe?
I don't know the precise answer to that. I mean, in general, there's peace in Israel. But that's a separate issue from robbers, you know, ruffians, hooligans, who are, as we know from the Samaritan Road and the Good Samaritan story, who attack people, rob them, leave them half dead, and move on. So that's why you never travel alone. You always travel in caravans, and the caravans must be separate, men and women. So this kind of changes our notion of the Christmas motif, but it then raises the question, where did they stay at night? Well, they're coming down the Central Ridge Route, which is a trade route, which means there are going to be inns. And that word is, my Greek isn't that great, but karavanisia. And those are rough and tumble common affairs. It's probably a round circle of a stone wall that's maybe 18 inches thick and 4 foot high. It has no roof on it. It's just a place where you lay down on the ground and maybe a rock is your pillow. And that's where you sleep at night. And Mary and Joseph aren't going to be sleeping together. So a lot of time for Mary to ponder. Did she sleep all those nights, or was she awake most of those nights thinking about her situation, her predicament, what's about to happen, what it's all going to mean? I mean, I don't know, but I do know the motif of the two of them walking together 90 miles on the Central Ridge isn't the way it happened.
I wonder if they could have felt like almost like fugitives, because what was apparent to the community that there was this pregnancy out of wedlock is capital punishment. I mean, that could be stoning. I mean, they could well have felt they were each standing in line for that kind of an end.
There's some diversity in rabbinic thought of what you do in this kind of a situation. The most extreme case, of course, is death by stoning. The least severe case is you sort of become a woman with a scarlet letter on your forehead. Mm-hmm. And you're forbidden from marrying for the rest of your days, and your offborn, either son or daughter, gets entered into the official genealogical records as the, I won't say it over the radio, but it's the B son.
You can say it. It's a legal term, bastard.
Yeah, that's the word.
That would have been on the record for Jesus then, you were saying? Possibly.
Don't know that, because all the records got destroyed, but that's how the system worked, mm-hmm. Okay? And the reason that was entered into the genealogical records that way, if it was Jesus, all right, I'm not saying it was, but if it was, it would be entered in as Yeshua, the bastard son of Miriam, Mary. And that meant, because of the title bastard, that son or daughter was forbidden from ever marrying. Now you see how the key thesis of the Da Vinci Code just gets that particular contextual observation. There's no way that Jesus could have married Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been permitted. He wasn't permitted to do that, if indeed it was recorded and perceived that way. And there's every indication to think it was certainly perceived that way, because there was one point in the gospel message when the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, "We know who our father is." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Implication, you don't.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, so some things to think about. Going back to the time of year, the Mishnah tells us that the Davidic clan...
Now, the Mishnah, is a collection of rabbinical writings that was put together in about 200 A.D., so 200 years after the time we're talking about here. But it was like a chronology, a history of the rabbinical thought on a whole bunch of issues, correct?
Yeah, it's a codification and an organization of both the oral tradition and all of the sage wisdom that's been sort of accumulated on top of the Torah through hundreds and hundreds and a thousand more years.
So it's kind of a commentary then.
Pretty much so, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was done in 200 AD when Judaism got a little more organized. Because here's the issue that Judaism struggled with. Once the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem, you couldn't get right with God. Okay? You couldn't get righteous, because the temple stood for a system of righteousness that if you did scrupulous behavior, and if you went to the ritual purification baths whenever you inadvertently messed up one of the many rules of purity, and you went to the temple in Jerusalem and did the sacrifices and the incense offerings, you were righteous by definition. It was a very mechanical kind of thing. And so now, and that's the role of the temple. It's where you go to get right with God. So what happens to Judaism? How do you get right with God? How do you get to be righteous if there no longer is a temple? I mean, this is quite an issue, and it gets debated a long, long time. And finally, that all gets sort of sorted out and written down and codified. And I think the answer will bring a smile to your face. Basically, the conclusion was made The way you get right with God is scrupulous behavior and ritual purification baths when you inadvertently mess up, and philanthropy. Giving things away. And that notion of philanthropy in Judaism is still very, very strong. You know, all of the Mount Sinai and Cedar Sinai hospitals around the country, you know, that were put up by Jewish people. A lot of public arenas, libraries, events have been funded through Jewish philanthropy. And the legacy of that still is around, interestingly enough. But anyway, they wrote all this down in 200 AD, and Rabbinic Judaism got highly organized at that point. It was much more informal during Jesus' time in the first century. And so that's some of the issues that we have to deal with in interpretation, is we know what the Mishnah says for 200 AD. How much of what it says would have been applicable back in 30 AD or 30 or time zero, you know, at the time of Jesus, when Rabbinic Judaism was much more informal.
And again, the year of his birth, they think between what, 4 and 6 B.C.?
Yes.
All right. Just so we get the time right there.
Probably 6, Herod the Great dies in 4. And that whole notion there is a fascinating one by itself. How did they miss ground zero? But for another time and another day.
Okay.
All right. So if you were Joseph and you had this year window of time to go to Bethlehem to register where the head of your clan is based, what time of year would you pick?
Well, I'd go when traveling is best. I'm figuring the warmer months, not the cold months, not winter.
I tell you, the least probable time you'd pick would be late December, right? Because it snows, right. And it's cold. Central Ridge is at 2,800 feet in the air. It can get icy.
And you're out there in the great outdoors for 3-4 days on a walking journey.
Yeah. So this notion of a December birth doesn't really hold water. Let me give you another fact. Once again, the Mishnah tells us that the Davidic clan was responsible for the month of July for being the support system, the infrastructure for the wood offerings in the temple in Jerusalem.
So Joseph may have been killing two birds with one stone, so to speak.
How about that?
Making his trip efficient, complying with the census at the same time he had to be at the temple. Maybe, and this leads, you say bringing wood, so he may have packed in with some animals carrying wood. Is that possible from the woods, the forest in the north?
No, I don't think it would have done that way. There was enough wood that they could have prepared, chopped, etc., down in the Judean district there.
Okay.
But it does suggest a time of year. Now, that dovetails with another fact that Luke gives us. We're probably going to have to deal with that next week about the shepherds. But Luke tells us that shepherds were in the fields at night. Normally, sheep are not going to be allowed in the fields unless the wheat harvest is complete. Because after the wheat harvest is complete, they welcome sheep to be in the fields because their droppings create manure, which is sort of a natural fertilizer. So, point of information, the wheat harvest is over in the Bethlehem area end of June, early July.
Would that perhaps be lambing season also?
There is an argument that there are two waves, birthing seasons. That's probably best kept for next week.
Okay.
One is around the 1st of April, and the second one is end of June, early July.
Well, see, there are clues once you know the culture as to when all this took place and why. And when you're not exposed to that context, it's so easy to be confused. I mean, this has a way of straightening things out and making it pop out in three dimensions, doesn't it?
I guess we have to say what we always say. Context matters when we encounter the scriptures.
Boy, it does. It does. Doug Greenwald, again, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. Their website is gorgeous, by the way. It's a brand new website, and you can link to it from ours. That's preservingbibletimes.org. You can buy stuff there that will feed your church and feed your small groups and fuel your Bible studies and provoke discussions and ideas. Even our Digging Deeper series is available on CD from them. And lots of photographs to see. You've got a lot of photographs of your recent Italian trips, don't you?
We do, and we've got a lot of free things for downloads, too, mm-hmm. for people to give them some insight into this world of biblical context.
Well, you can sign up for Doug's monthly reflection newsletter there. It doesn't cost you a thing. It comes via email, and you find yourself looking forward to that every month. In fact, you've been doing it more often than monthly recently, haven't you?
Well, I've been doing the Pauline Glimpses series on a weekly basis here, and mm-hmm. probably will continue that for some time.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
Anyway, next week, shepherds, it looks like.
Well, I think so. We'll talk about the shepherds and who they were and maybe why they were chosen and how they reacted to that whole birth story. Doug, thanks very much. You have a safe week, a good week, and may the weather be warm, and may the low-pressure area over Washington lift at least briefly.
Okay, and David, don't forget the newest conspiracy theory.
I've just shared it with Twitter.
All right.
Yes.
We'll work on that one, Doug. Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom.
Shalom, Doug.